Welcome to the New Health Club podcast. If you want to know about psychedelics as new mental health tools, you came to the right place. I talk to innovators, thought leaders, and disruptors creating the future of mental health and mental wellness. This podcast deals with drugs. Drugs are dangerous, and you should not do drugs. Furthermore, the use and/or trade of drugs may be punishable by law. This podcast is not suitable for people under the age of 18. This episode of the New Health Club podcast is part of our special Heal Soul series, which is sponsored by Dr. Bronner's, the activist soap company from California. Dr. Bronner's is a family-owned company founded in 1948 that's dedicated to honoring the vision of its founder, Emmanuel Bronner, by making personal care products of the highest quality and by dedicating profits to promote a better world for all. The Bronner family started making soap in 1858 here in Germany and carries on the family soap making tradition today by using the company as an engine for progressive social change. Dr. Bronner's dedicates profits to organizations working in support of regenerative organic agriculture, animal rights, community betterment, criminal justice reform, fair pay and fair trade, and drug policy reform, which includes the responsible and equitable integration of psychedelic medicine into American and global culture. For more information on Dr. Bronner's in Germany, please visit drbronners.de. For more information on Dr. Bronner's globally and in the United States, please visit drbronner.com. Hi, and welcome to a new episode of the New Health Club podcast. My guest today is Daniel Carcillo, and he's a former professional NHL hockey player and two-time Stanley Cup champion who turned into a mental health, concussion, traumatic brain injury, plant medicine, and fungi advocate. He's an experienced speaker on the above topics through lived and personal experience. He's a farmer and entrepreneur with a fully integrated cannabis and medicinal mushroom business. Also, Daniel is part of the decriminalized Chicago movement. During a podcast, Daniel was sitting in his car since his kids took over the house in the afternoon. So we really had the chance to talk about the hero dose of psilocybin Daniel was trying when his depression took over. We talk about his changing idea of being an athlete and how he changed after his personal mental health crisis and depression after leaving a successful but destructive career as an athlete has changed. And of course, how this led him into the decriminalized Chicago movement. So please enjoy the podcast with Daniel Carcillo. We're very happy to have Daniel Carcillo. Is that the right pronunciation? Carcillo.
Almost, yeah. Carcillo. Yeah.
Carcillo. Okay. I think Carcillo is Argentinian.
Yeah, that's the European way. Carcillo is the Italian way.
Okay. So, but is it Italian or is it Spanish?
Italian.
Okay. So you say Carcillo, right?
Carcillo,
yeah. Carcillo, okay, perfect. So Daniel Carcillo, okay. Very happy to have you on the New Health Club podcast together with the Heal Soul sessions for Dr. Bronner's. And you are the, let's say, the main character if it comes to the decriminalization movement in Chicago, which is a very big one, as I researched before I started the show. So maybe you start to talk a little bit about yourself and, of course, how you got into this new endeavor after being an athlete for a long time.
Yeah, of course. So thank you. And it's nice to be here. And it's a great campaign. So I'm glad to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. And thanks to Bronner Soaps for all they do. But yeah, I'm Daniel Carcillo, and I played 12 years professionally in the NHL and was forced to retire due to post-concussion syndrome, which brings on a whole host of ailments as far as anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, head pressure, insomnia, slurred speech, light sensitivity. So when I retired, I was really struggling. Nobody really talked about mental health or concussion and what could happen afterwards. And so post-retirement, just struggled for probably four or five, almost 4 years, and tried, you know, every treatment under the sun as far as functional neurology and, you know, self-deprivation tanks, MOXA, acupuncture, neurofeedback, TMS, SPECT scans, QEEGs, and nothing was working. I wasn't regaining my quality of life or my brain health. And a year ago, I came across plant medicines and fungi. As far as CBD goes, I was invited to a farm June 1 of last year to learn about genetics. And it was by a friend who knew I'd been struggling. And they introduced me to a hero dose of psilocybin. And that's really where I can pinpoint my life turning around. And throughout this journey, I tracked my progress with QEEGs, with brain scans and blood work. And last June 1, before I did that treatment, I was in a really dark place because I'd taken more tests and just nothing was working and a lot of money spent, a lot of time put towards it, and I wasn't getting better. And after this ceremony at the farm, I just researched because I like to read a lot of medical papers and see if there's anything I can pinpoint that would work for me. And when I was reading about how trauma, emotional and physical, the concussion shut down areas of your brain, started to make sense to me as to why this psilocybin treatment could work, because it stimulates different areas, specifically the frontal lobes. And so then I was, you know, just waiting. I like to put a lot of time under my belt before I come out and say anything. But around November, I got introduced to Carlos and Larry of the Decriminalized Nature Oakland movement, and I decided to bring forward that resolution because it had been a substantial amount of time to where my communication levels with my wife got better. I wanted to be around my kids. Loud noises weren't affecting me. Slurred speech was gone. My QEEG at 6 months came back with no abnormalities. So I really made quite a turnaround and realized that this worked for me. And I was advocating on social media a lot for TBI and mental health and concussion, and I could realize that this could work for these communities as well. So brought forward the resolution and started to do an educational campaign behind the scenes with the city's aldermen. And we had two hearings set with Human and Health Committee, but COVID pushed both of those back. So we're just kind of waiting in a holding period right now, waiting for everything to open up and then bring our presentation forward with a really diverse group of people that this medicine has helped, and just show how responsibly it can be used and how it can help to heal trauma. And I think we look around this day and age, it's a lot of people exhibiting a lot of anger, and rightfully so. And I think that we need to, you know, get back to original medicines and find ways to integrate this type of life-saving therapy into our communities and traumatized communities.
And I mean, your story is very, I mean, if you look at a couple of videos you did and even pictures, I mean, you also were very outspoken about how the NFL doesn't address anything like that, that it basically, I'm going to say like it hurts to the point players and athletes that their life is actually, they can't retrace their life anymore after having the career in sports. So, I mean, if you do something like this after being a long time in let's say in a business or in a world like this, it kind of probably leads to a lot of rejection that from people that you maybe you used to be friends with, used to be your surrounding. So, I mean, how exactly did that happen? So, and how did you, dare to go forward with this?
So my friend passed away, who was my teammate and my best friend at the time. He was cleared by a team for 4 concussions. He had a total of 19 concussions, but he was cleared for his last 4 concussions in 12 weeks. And he really went on a downward spiral after that. And I saw some of the same symptoms in him that I saw in me. I had 7 concussions documented in the league. And I realized that nobody told us anything. Nobody warned us or told us the truth about the real risks of doing our job and the repetitive head trauma that we were sustaining, both through body checks on a daily basis and through headshots and fighting. And that really pissed me off. And I decided to do more research and just started to read, you know, the emails that were made public. There were 297 of them. And you could see how the league set was violence, hate, and rivalries. And at the very least, you know, didn't treat us with enough respect to tell us the information that they knew. And so we weren't able to make educated decisions about whether or not we should continue to play when we saw these signs and symptoms. And let alone seeing them, we couldn't recognize them because we were never educated on what they are and what the real risks are. And the real risks are, you know, losing your family and losing your sense of self and really struggling afterwards. And yeah, I don't have, you know, the same friends that I did while in the league, but that's okay. You know, I have a small circle and people that know me, you know, I keep close to, and some people don't understand it, but you know, the trials haven't happened yet either. So when the trials happen, then that information will be made public. And, you know, when I say it, I don't know if it carries as much weight just because a lot of people, they can't get over my past because I was a big perpetrator of this. I mean, I embodied that hate and rivalry, and I fought and I was aggressive and I was everything that they wanted me to be. And I just, after you learn something and after you see somebody struggle and then you struggle personally and you see hundreds of other guys struggling around you, it's not just isolated incidences and it's not just enforcers. There's superstars retiring now. I think they need to learn a lesson. And I think that the cases that are coming against them will hopefully hold their feet to the fire. And then the public, when it's in court of public opinion, I think when this information comes out and it's not delivered by my mouth, it'll have a different impact and people will realize, you know, the importance of doing this. Because it's sad to say, but professional hockey players right now, they're in trouble. You know, they've never gotten treated. So they're going to have some type of mild cognitive impairment when they leave the game. That's just normal. And so it just depends on how badly like it can affect their life and how quickly they get treatment. And it's for kids and parents so that they know, you know, the real risks. And, you know, they've done some good things like moving the body checking up to 14. But I think there really needs to be more education on how to recover from a concussion and the time frame. And, you know, if this is a bruise on the brain, essentially, or tears to the white matter of the brain, I think it takes a little longer than 7 days to heal. And those are the current guidelines. But then wow. You delve into who these doctors are, and a lot of them have like really strong relationships to collision sports. So it's a long road, but you know, we stay the course, and I have a lot of really great things around me that I'm not solely, you know, 100% putting all my energy to that every single day. But you know, my lawyer's been in touch recently, and I'm like, you know, critical witness with Steve Monador's case. And so I think it could change the world. You know, I really do. I think it can. There's no such thing as a sports-related concussion, or, you know, it's just a concussion. There's no such thing as a car accident concussion. They just call it a concussion, you know. And so I just want people to be educated about it, you know.
I mean, after you call it like hero dose of psilocybin, so would you say, obviously that happened, that after this you got involved into the decriminalized movement, or were you in touch with that before, or was it something that was kind of leading you in a very in this direction, actually?
No, it was a surprise, a total surprise that I was going to do that on that night. And, you know, I guess they always say, like, the medicine calls you, and, you know, a friend just introduced me to it, and I was in the right place at the right time. But afterwards, I'm the type of mind that needs to, like, I need to delve in. I need to know why it's working for me. If it works for me, that means it possibly worked for other people. And I was an extreme case, so it worked so well that I think, you know, I'm doing things on the back end about, you know, the advocacy work and you know, exploring other avenues of really getting this type of treatment to people. And yeah, it was after the hero dose, when I started to like show people that I was healthy. I think that's the biggest thing. They could see it, they could hear it. The research came, the science, and then it started making a lot of sense to me. And then it was, okay, how do I now get behind it and use my platform to push this education and information as a possible tool? It's not the only tool, because there's other things I changed, you know, and added into my life, like intermittent fasting and, you know, watching my refined white sugar intake, and there's other things that go along with this, but it's a pretty amazing tool if you can add it to a holistic regimen for your lifestyle and for brain function and for just optimizing everything, like your relationships and your creativity, your energy levels. It's really amazing.
So, and what was your first step after you've done this and then you realize, okay, you want to kind of communicate this also to other people or even like in obviously in a political context. So what was the moment when you thought, okay, you want to be part of this decriminalized movement? Because I mean, it's also, it's hard work also to keep coming back and talking to people who think it's like crazy stuff, psychedelics. So like, you kind of have to repeat yourself many times. How did you get into your, let's call it your new life as a decrim pro?
I don't know if you'd call me that. I'm, you know, a Canadian guy and I'm just learning. But, you know, I have a really great alderman with Brian Hopkins and a great relationship with him. And we've just been doing our best to let the science speak, and with the written and oral testimony that's already been submitted, and the science and the links to the papers. And we're just trying to show people that, especially for this city, it could work for the recidivism rate and for the opioid crisis. And so education is first and foremost, with educating those people that are going to vote on it. And their biggest concern is the safety and efficacy. And that's been proven numerous times now in these publications from, you know, organizations like John Hopkins and NYU, mm-hmm. Imperial College of London. So the safety's there, and now just the education is needed. But, you know, you find time when something like this saves your life, and you know how close you were to ending your life. It has to work. I know it's going to work for other people, and it's a natural remedy, and it's just really exciting.
How did you get in touch with Dr. Bronis? How did that happen?
I think that was through Kevin Matthews and Spore. We spoke, and they told me about what they were doing and thinking about doing, and how they were going to integrate into the decrim nature sphere and support that, and everyone was going to support each other. And so the company's amazing, the way that it's structured and everything about it, especially me having a young company. It's just a nice model to follow. And so we've struck up that type of relationship. I've offered my story. We just did a really great boot camp, and he's really helped out on my foundation and with Chapter 5 as well. So yeah, he's a great asset to, you know, have alongside in this fight for decriminalization.
I mean, I talked to Melissa Lavassani from Washington Decrim Department. So, and I mean, I found it interesting that her, let's call it like strategy, is that without it, she knew it would be a strategy. That first of all, she's this, like she says, like she's so the super normal mom with two kids that helps a lot to talk to people. And then also the other thing is that she tries to engage with as much Republicans as possible, because if you have these two kind of things covered, people that actually see that would actually start to respond differently to a person talking about the healing powers of psychedelics. I mean, her story is also very, you know, like she basically also said that she was very suicidal, and this was the only thing that helped her after having her, I think, second child. So how do you actually proceed in your case? Do you try to, but do you have this thing like you talk to everybody, or do you try to convince a special group of people where you think that makes really sense to get them on your team?
Yeah, I think convincing naysayers is important, and it's not their fault. We've all, in some way, shape, or form, been, you know, had this stigmatized message about these medicines in our mind. I know I have, and I'm 35, and I'm sure you have. And
yeah,
you know, this stuff's poison for your brain, and it's a gateway drug, and so I think just showing people science. That's why I really like how the science leads the way here, showing safety and efficacy. So showing people that, and they can't, it's not like me telling them. And then there's also people that, you know, feel passionately about this, but are scared to talk about it, you know, and scared to come out. And so, you know, talking to them is, you know, just convincing them of the good that they can do. And that, you know, this type of movement is really important to be able to get people this knowledge and this framework of this grow, gather, and gift model that Oakland believes so strongly in and the decriminalized nature movement believes in. And this is the first step to real change. So we are targeting, I mean, for the most part right now, the aldermen that are going to be voting on this. And then, you know, obviously with everything that's happened, slowed down on the engagement, but active on social media. And anybody, you know, is interested in reaching out, it's decriminalizedchicago@gmail.com. And please do. And yeah, I'm sure once everything starts opening up, we're going to start with a ramp up the public side of the campaign.
So that means you're going to go on the stage in Chicago?
Yeah, right.
All on the a festival.
Go across all the theaters.
Well, yeah, I mean, the future of theaters is uncertain, I guess. But I mean, that's an interesting question, actually. So because, of course, the decrim movement was alive and kicking, and then suddenly COVID kicked in. And, of course, like this whole kind of public speaking, like public places. I mean, I think Melissa also talked about this, where you could just go and gather and like, you know, talk to people. This suddenly stopped, like out of the blue. So what were your strategies when you couldn't, when you just had to stop gathering a lot of people, you know, around somebody talking about this? So what are or were your COVID strategies to reach people?
Social media and Zoom calls have been good, email chains, and just keeping everybody aware if there's any changes with what comes down with the Human and Health Committee and when we might possibly be able to testify in the future. So just keeping everybody, you know, ready and engaged. And yeah, the public campaign really just took a backseat to first educating the aldermen without kind of, you know, coming around the other side and smacking them in the face with a big public campaign. So that was kind of the strategy here. But that's most definitely coming, and events will be coming and sent right. I mean, you gather and you can talk, you know, deliver a message with people face to face. Like, that is still where I think a lot of the magic happens. Mm-hmm. This is great. But, you know, if you're sitting, you know, face to face across from each other, granted, even if it's 6 feet, it's just much better, you know. So I'm looking forward to when that happens and letting everybody know where we'll be and engaging with people.
I mean, what is your favorite or your best argument if somebody says, well, psychedelics is something that's just crazy making and it's from the 60s and it's from hippies, so we better don't touch it anymore, which surprisingly, a lot of people, I mean, even in Europe, kind of have in the back of their mind if they hear the word psychedelics these days.
Right. Yeah. And that's the stigma, right? That's been ingrained. I would just say, like, I have in my notes, it's called Publications for the Haters. And I usually just copy and paste that whenever I get it and then send it to them. And they can make their own judgment. It's from Johns Hopkins University. And there's a lot of publications, you know, and it's hard to ignore that. And I think if you educate them a little bit on why these, you know, medicines were criminalized in the first place, it wasn't because of science. It wasn't as if these medicines were showing that they were, you know, really, really bad for us and had a high addiction rate and no medicinal value whatsoever. We're showing the exact opposite. So, you know, the Nixon with the war on drugs and a lot of these movements, as well as, you know, the counterculture movement, it was just the perfect storm for them to, you know, continue to enslave certain communities, you know, communities of color and minorities. And so it's been a really, I know it's been a long fight. I'm just joining this fight and just getting educated as well. But you can see how this has been going on for a really, really long time. And you have people serving close to life sentences for less than an ounce of marijuana in jail still. So it's, again, just showing people and talking to them and delivering a message about science. Like, for example, when I talk to TBI patients, I have this image, you know, saved on my phone from the Beckley Institute about the right and left brain hemispheres communicating a placebo and then brain on psilocybin. And hard to ignore that image, you know, and that usually leads into a conversation. And then I don't, you know, put my happiness, and it's not dependent on somebody convincing somebody. It's just showing them the information, and then they can make their own educated decision.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what was your, what would you say was your main, if you want to talk about this, main experience in your own psychedelic or like psilocybin trip experience?
What did it, what do you mean by main? Like, what did
well,
it,
I mean, the thing is,
the ultimate lesson?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I find often it's like there's one or two things that are really, I mean, probably the things that become very transformative after this or after like putting them into integration. So, and I mean, sometimes I think it takes a while until you realize what it really was. But so, yeah, I mean, it would be great if you could talk about what for you was the main insight or like the main thing where you from, you took this as a new beginning for your life, actually, maybe.
Yeah. So I was lost before I went there, really depressed, suicidal. And the medicine tends to show you and exasperate exactly what's wrong. So it was a new place that I was at, and I, you know, just took this medicine, and I found myself caught in a loop for 90 minutes where I didn't quite know where I was. And, you know, I was kind of working something out, definitely some like really bad energy. But that, after I was done with that kind of 90 minute, you know, it was like, it was really difficult. But it showed me, it confirmed how I felt, that I was definitely lost and I didn't know which way to go or what to do or what treatment to do or next job to take. And, and then, you know, after that, I went back and I was there to learn about farming. And so I started farming, and then, you know, I started taking CBD along with medicinal mushrooms and this medicine in a microdose form. And I just started to get better. And I committed to that. And as I started to get better, things started to change for me a month later, even 2 months later. Specifically, I remember an event where I was driving out to my plants, and, it was, you know, they were probably about like 2.5 feet or so. And I had a thought like, wow, a really good job, Dan. And I was just kind of dumbfounded because I never used to speak to myself that way. And that was something that all of a sudden, for some reason, changed. I started, again, I mentioned it before, but communicating with my wife more and just, you know, getting more connected instead of wanting to be disconnected. Mm. So those were some really major things. And then I started to get like really creative. You know, I can multitask really well now. I just feel as if like my brain health has been better than it ever has been. And I keep getting better. So that's really exciting. And, you know, there's certain protocols that I follow that have been working for me. And, you know, it's just, it's been like a really, just really amazing turnaround. But yeah, it's, the medicine is, if you can, you know, luckily I've had a lot of talk therapy, so I kind of knew like what to look for as far as trying to integrate the lessons that I saw and take the lessons and set the intention and, you know, manage the dose, and the setting was managed. So everything was responsibly done. But yeah, there was definitely things afterwards, weeks after that, that were popping up still.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, I mean, like coming back to the decrim movements, I mean, of course, every place has this, has their own specific requirements. I mean, obviously, if you're in Washington, you can't imagine what your the things are going to be you're mostly going to encounter. So, but I mean, Chicago is, I mean, I have to be honest, I have no feeling like how the city is embracing these kind of movements. Because I mean, Oregon, of course, it's like it's always been more like an, let's say, a place that was always very open for these things. But Chicago seems to me like a very, I mean, besides the old mafia movies that you know, it seems to be like a very business-ish driven city. So how is it to do this in Chicago? Like in a kind of a, I mean, it's not California, like where everybody's like, whoa, shrooms, let's go do shrooms and go to the desert. So it's a whole different thing. So how do you approach Chicago and mushrooms?
Yeah, I mean, I know I keep coming back to it, but I think I always lead with like my social media, always leading with, you know, articles that are coming out in you know, pharmacology publications, and again, just leading with science and like letting people know too that I think a lot of people in this city are concerned with the recidivism rate and obviously the opiate crisis, but this medicine doesn't need to be just for sick people as well. You know, it can make you more creative and optimize your brain health and help with anti-aging, and it's being researched for neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. So it's, you know, it's not just a one trick pony, so to speak. And there's lots of companies now, private and public, you know, studying these compounds in human trials. So in some ways you can be lucky. Obviously we're all stigmatized towards it, but I think that if you lead with that information that I've been talking about as far as data and science goes, and you can put together a really poignant campaign to just show people, number one, the safety and efficacy of it first and foremost, then you can start talking about how many great advantages it would have within the community, and the jobs that it would create and the healing that it would promote. So that would be, you know, the biggest thing that we're going to try to do when we do initiate that public aspect to the campaign.
Mm-hmm. And do you interact a lot with the other decrim kind of movements or centers? Do you connect to each other on a regular basis?
Yeah, we have these weekly, monthly calls, as well as I've offered my testimony to the decriminalized DC mm-hmm. movement, the board of elections, and so there's a lot of parallels, and we try to support each other as a community and just uplift. And just recently submitted some written testimony for Ann Arbor, so
Ann Arbor
nature there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's been you know, a really great community to be a part of, kind of like, you know, a second team, so to speak.
So that means there's a whole, you could say, like, network all over the country that in the end is going to be almost like a net over America, like where every city has their decrim movement. Is that kind of the aim of this?
Yeah, there's a lot of movements popping up. Yeah. And we're just all trying to support each other, and when one is successful, I think that's why we tried to, you know, model something after the DC campaign. And
mm-hmm.
We're going to learn a lot from that. And then we can kind of just spread out like a mycelium network, if you will, and just provide information and support and change that stigma, you know, and show people how safe and transformative this medicine really is.
And what is your, let's say, vision for this in a couple of years? I mean, hopefully after a new government has taken over America, hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, the vision would be for everybody to have access to this medicine and mm-hmm. people not to be thrown in prison for growing it and using it responsibly, whether that's the clinical model, which I'm sure will mm-hmm. come through, whether that's the pharmaceutical model, over-the-counter prescriptions, whether that's growing it in the comfort of your own home and administering the medicine whenever you want to or whenever you feel necessary. I think all of these models can live.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they all work together for the common goal. I mean, if you're not in this to help as many people as possible and support as many movements as possible, even though they might, you know, not necessarily be the same as yours, then I think you're doing it for the wrong reasons. So just trying to, you know, uplift and shine light on everybody and everyone that's coming together doing really amazing work.
So I find it interesting what you just said also, and also in terms of how you self got to kind of, let's say, familiar with this. Like you had somebody leading you to this, let's say, high-dose psilocybin experience that changed a lot. But then you also tried to almost like customize your own very personal kind of medication. It's like a big word, but like rather plant intake.
It's medication for sure. I treat it as medication.
Yeah, but I mean, I find that interesting what you said, because I think at the moment, it's the first time when you said it, that a couple of times I thought about it, but now in your case, it's so interesting to see how one could start with a couple of, let's say, lessons, how this can work in your life or for your life. But then you can also kind of find your way through a very personal kind of use without being, of course, kind of abuse it, which is, I don't think, not very possible with psilocybin, because we know from the science that it doesn't have your usual addiction structure. And I also heard from a couple of scientists that we talked to, the more often you do it, like if you would do it very, very often and in a very high dose, you wouldn't experience the high dose anymore in a way. So, do you think that this will be at one point a model that we have like a very personalized kind of use of plant-based medicine?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think that, again, this is a tool that can be used responsibly within a holistic lifestyle. And mm-hmm. I mean, I take my capsules in the morning on an empty stomach, most times in the afternoon as well, just to break my fast. So that's another tool.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think just somebody there to tell you about that and guide you, not necessarily just hand you a bottle of pills over the counter, but
yeah,
there's always instructions that can come along with it. And yeah, these mushrooms are amazing. You know, they communicate and they know, you know, they have this like safety mechanism built in, which is tolerance. And if you take too much, then you're not going to feel the effects, you know?
Yeah.
So, again, responsible use, responsible dosing, definitely education about different dosing regimens, because there are have been proven a handful of different dosing regimens, and then just trying it out on your own, because the reality is there's little to no side effects with the medicine that they can see. And so I think it's important to, because it's so individualized, to, you know, try each protocol yourself and just see, gauge how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, hopefully we get to a point where there's a lot of education about different strains, especially if people are taking it in a natural setting and not through a pharmaceutical model, because different strains do different things. And so yeah, there's lots of work to be done for sure. But the number one, I think, key issue is just responsibly done. You know, let's not mess this up.
Mm. Well, that's a good, kind of a good last words. Let's not mess this up. This goes for the whole movement. So,
sure.
Yeah, thank you very much for doing this. Although you have a lot of kid stuff on your hands right now at 4 o'clock. Is it 5 o'clock almost at your place?
Oh, yeah, I got five of them behind me right now. So,
okay, wow.
It's all good. This was great. So appreciate the conversation.
No, of course. Thank you. I also saw that your birthday is one day before mine. So,
that's very
excited. All these psychedelic people have the same birthday. Yeah, thank you so much.
I guess we got to talk about our sign now.
Aquarius.
Yeah.
Well, it's a typical Aquarius thing, isn't it? I mean, it's like everything comes together in psychedelics. That's super Aquarian. Thank you so much. Have a great day in Chicago. Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.